human's being. He insisted no further. The boy's arms were still embracing the girl. They could hear each other's naked throbbing. A long kiss tortured the unsatisfied boy, but then, at a certain instant, this pain was transformed into a strange elation. From time to time, the dying fire crackled a little. They heard this sound and the whistling of the storm as it swept past the high windows, all mixed with the beating of their hearts. To Shinji, it seemed as though this unceasing feeling of intoxication and the confused booming of the sea outside and the noise of the storm among the treetops were all beating with nature's violent rhythm. And as part of his emotion there was the feeling, forever and ever, of pure and holy happiness. He moved his body away from hers, then he spoke in a manly, composed tone of voice. "Today on the beach I found a pretty shell and brought it for you."
"Oh, thanks. Let me see it."
Getting up, Shinji went to where his clothes had fallen and began putting them on. At the same time, Hatsue softly pulled on her chemise and then put on the rest of her clothes. After they were both fully dressed, the boy brought the shell to where the girl was sitting.
"My, it is pretty."
Delighted, the girl mirrored the flames in the smooth face of the shell. Then she held it up against her hair and said,
"It looks like coral, doesn't it? Wonder if it wouldn't even make a pretty hair ornament."
Shinji sat down on the floor close beside the girl. Now that they were dressed, they could kiss in comfort. When they started back, the storm still had not abated. So this time, Shinji did not part from her above the lighthouse, did not take a different path out of deference to what the people in the lighthouse might think. Instead, together they followed the slightly easier path that led down past the rear of the lighthouse. Then, arm in arm, they descended the stone stairs leading from the lighthouse past the residence. Chiyoko had come home, and by the next day was overcome with boredom. Not even Shinji came to see her. Finally, a regular meeting of the etiquette class brought the village girls to the house. There was an unfamiliar face among them. Chiyoko realized this must be the Hatsue of whom Yasuo had spoken, and she found Hatsue's rustic features even more beautiful than the islanders said they were. This was an odd virtue of Chiyoko's. Although a woman with the slightest degree of self-confidence will never cease pointing out another woman's defects, Chiyoko was even more honest than a man in always recognizing anything beautiful about any woman except herself. With nothing better to do, Chiyoko had begun studying her history of English literature. Knowing not a single one of their works, she memorized the names of a group of Victorian lady poets, Christina Georgina Rossetti, Adelaide Ann Procter, Jean Ingelow, Augusta Webster, exactly as though she were memorizing Buddhist scriptures. Rote memorization was Chiyoko's forte. Even the professor's sneezes were recorded in her notes. Her mother was constantly at her side, eager to gain new knowledge from her daughter. Going to the university had been Chiyoko's idea in the first place, but it had been her mother's enthusiastic support that had overcome her father's reluctance. Her thirst for knowledge, whetted by a life of moving from lighthouse to lighthouse, from remote island to remote island, the mother always pictured her daughter's life as an ideal dream. Never once did her eyes perceive her daughter's little inner unhappiness. On the morning of the storm, both mother and daughter slept late. The storm had been building up since the evening before, and they had kept vigil most of the night with the lighthouse keeper, who took his responsibilities most seriously. Very much contrary to their usual ways, their midday meal was also their breakfast. And after the table had been cleared, the three of them passed the time quietly indoors, shut in by the storm. Chiyoko began to long for Tokyo. She longed for the Tokyo where, even on such a stormy day, the automobiles went back and forth as usual, the elevators went up and down, and the streetcars bustled along. There in the city, almost all nature had been put into uniform, and the little power of nature that remained was an enemy. Here on the island, however, the islanders enthusiastically entered into an alliance with nature and gave it their full support. Bored with studying, Chiyoko pressed her face against the windowpane and gazed out at the storm that kept her shut up in the house. The storm was a monotone of dullness. The roar of the waves came as persistently as the garrulity of a drunk man. For some reason, Chiyoko recalled the gossip about a classmate who had been seduced by the man she was in love with. The girl had loved the man for his gentleness and refinement, and had even said so openly. After that night, so the story went, she loved him for his violence and willfulness. But this she never breathed to anyone. At this moment, Chiyoko caught sight of Shinji descending the storm-swept stairs with Hatsue snuggled against him. Chiyoko was convinced of the advantages of a face as ugly as she believed her own to be. Once such a face hardened in its mold, it could hide emotions far more cleverly than could a beautiful one. What she regarded as ugly, however, was actually only the plaster of Paris mask of self-preoccupied virginity. She turned away from the window. Beside the sunken hearth, her mother was sewing, and her father was silently smoking his new life. Outdoors was the storm, indoors, domesticity. Nowhere was there anyone to heed Chiyoko's unhappiness. Chiyoko returned to her desk and opened the English book. The words had no meaning. There was nothing but the lines of type running down the page. Between the lines, the vision of birds wheeling high and low flickered in her eyes. They were seagulls. "When I return to the island," Chiyoko told herself, "and made that bet about a seagull flying over Toba's tower, this is what the sign meant." Chapter 9. A message came by express delivery from Hiroshi on his trip. It was written on a picture postcard showing Kyoto's famous Kiyomizu Temple and was impressed with a large purple souvenir seal. If he had sent it by ordinary mail, he himself would probably have been back on the island before it arrived. Even before reading it, his mother became angry, saying that Hiroshi had been extravagant to pay all that extra postage, that children nowadays didn't know the value of money. Hiroshi's closely written card was all about seeing his first motion picture, with not so much as a word about the famous scenic spots and historic places he was seeing. "The first night in Kyoto, they let us do as we pleased, so So-chan, Kat-chan, and I went straight to a big movie house in the neighborhood. It was really swell, just like a palace. But the seats seemed awful narrow and hard, and when we tried to sit on them, it was just like perching on a chicken roost. Our bottoms hurt so that we couldn't get comfortable at all. After a few minutes, the man behind us yelled, 'Down in front! Down in front!' We were already sitting down, so we thought this was funny. But then the man very kindly showed us what to do. He said they were folding seats, and then if we'd turned them down, they'd become chairs. We all scratched our heads, knowing we'd made a foolish mistake. And when we put them down, sure enough, they were seats soft enough for the emperor himself to sit on. I told myself that someday I'd like to have mother sit on these seats too." As Shinji read the card aloud for his mother, that last sentence brought tears to her eyes. She put the card up on the god shelf and made Shinji kneel down with her to pray that the storm 2 days before had not interfered with Hiroshi's excursion and that nothing would happen to him before he came home the day after tomorrow. After a minute, as though the thought had just occurred to her, she started heaping Shinji with abuse, going on about how terrible his reading and writing were and how much smarter Hiroshi was than he. What she called Hiroshi's smartness was nothing more or less than his ability to make her shed happy tears. She wasted no time in hurrying off to show the postcard at the homes of Hiroshi's friends, So-chan and Kat-chan. Later that evening, when she and Shinji went to the public bath, she met the postmaster's wife, and she got down on her bare knees in the midst of the steam to bow and thank her because the express delivery had been made in such good order. Shinji soon finished his bathing and waited before the bathhouse entrance for his mother to come out of the woman's side. The carved and painted wood under the eaves of the bathhouse was faded and peeling where the steam came curling out. The night was warm, the sea calm. Shinji noticed someone standing a few yards farther along the street, his back turned in Shinji's direction, apparently looking up toward the eaves of one of the houses. The man stood with both hands in his pockets and was beating time on the flagstones with his wooden clogs. In the twilight, Shinji could see that he was wearing a brown leather jacket. On Utajima, it was not everyone who could afford a leather jacket, and Shinji was sure this was Yasuo. Just as Shinji was about to call out to him, Yasuo happened to turn around. Shinji smiled, but Yasuo only stared back at him, the blank expression on his face never changing, and then turned away again. Shinji did not particularly take this as a slight, but it did seem a bit odd. Just then, his mother came out of the bathhouse, and the boy walked along home with her, silent as usual. The day before, after the boats had returned from a day of fishing in the fine weather that followed the storm, Chiyoko had gone to see Yasuo. She said that she had come to the village shopping with her mother and had decided to drop by, and explained her coming to Yasuo's place alone by saying her mother was visiting the home of the head of the cooperative, which was nearby. Chiyoko's version of how she had seen Shinji and Hatsue coming down together from the deserted mountain, clinging to each other, certainly did nothing to make the event less compromising, and her story was a staggering blow to Yasuo's pride. He brooded about it all night, and the next night, when Shinji happened to see him, what he was actually doing was reading the roster displayed under the eaves of a house beside the steep street that ran through the center of the village. Utajima had a meager water supply, which reached its lowest point about the time of the old calendar New Year, leading to endless quarrels over water rights. The village's sole source of water was a narrow stream beside the cobbled street that tumbled in flights of steps down through the center of the village. During the wet season, or after a heavy rain, the stream would become a muddy torrent, on whose banks the village women would do their laundry, chattering together noisily. Here, too, the children would hold the launching ceremonies for their hand-carved warships. But during the dry season, the stream would all but become a dried-up marsh, without strength enough to wash away even the slightest bit of rubbish. The stream was fed by a spring. Perhaps it was because the rains that fell on the peaks of the island all filtered down to this spring, but whatever the cause, this was the only such spring on the island. Hence, the village government had long since been given the power of determining the order in which the villagers should draw their water, the order being rotated each week. Only the lighthouse filtered rainwater and stored it in a tank. All the other houses on the island depended solely upon this spring, and each family in its turn had to put up with the inconvenience of being assigned the midnight hours for water drawing. But after a few weeks, even a midnight turn would gradually move up the roster to the convenient hours of early morning. Drawing water was women's work. So Yasuo was looking up at the water drawing roster, posted where the most people passed. He found the name Miyata written precisely under the 2 a.m. column. This was Hatsue's turn. Yasuo clicked his tongue. He wished it were still octopus season, as the boats did not put out quite so early in the morning then. During the squid season, which had now arrived, the boats had to reach the fishing grounds in the Irako Channel by the crack of dawn. So every household was up preparing breakfast by 3 o'clock at the latest, and impatient houses were sending up smoke from their cooking fires even earlier. Even so, this was preferable to next week, when Hatsue's turn would come at 3 o'clock. Yasuo swore to himself that he would have Hatsue before the fishing boats put out the next morning. Standing looking at the roster, he had just made his firm resolve when he saw Shinji standing before the men's entrance to the bathhouse. The sight of Shinji annoyed him, so that he completely forgot his usual punctilious ways and turned his back to hurry home. Reaching home, Yasuo glanced out of the corner of his eye into the sitting room where his father and elder brother were still serving each other their evening sake and listening to a ballad singer on the radio, which was resounding throughout the house. Yasuo went straight on to his own room on the second floor, where he angrily puffed on a cigarette. Because of his experience and way of thinking, Yasuo saw the matter thus. As Shinji had seduced Hatsue, he had certainly been no virgin. All the time he had been coming to the meetings of the Young Men's Association, sitting there innocently clasping his knees, smiling and listening attentively to the others' talk, putting on his childish airs. All that time he'd been having women on the sly. That damn little fox. And yet, given the honesty of Shinji's face, even Yasuo simply could not believe him capable of having won the girl by deceit. The inevitable conclusion then, and this was the most unbearable thought of all, was that Shinji had had his way with the girl fairly and squarely, with complete honesty. In bed that night, Yasuo kept pinching his thighs to keep from going to sleep. But this was not really necessary. The animosity he felt toward Shinji and the jealousy he felt at Shinji's having stolen a march on him were enough to keep him awake of themselves. Yasuo was the proud and always bragging owner of a watch with a luminous dial. Tonight he had left this on his wrist and had slipped into bed still wearing his jacket and trousers. From time to time, he put the watch to his ear, looking often at its luminously glowing face. In Yasuo's opinion, the mere ownership of such a wonderful watch made him by rights a favorite with the women. At 1:20, Yasuo stole out of the house. In the dead of the night, the sound of the waves could be plainly heard, and the moon was shining brightly. The village was silent. There were only 4 street lamps on the island, 1 at the jetty, 2 along the steep street through the center of the village, and 1 on the mountain beside the spring. Except for the ferry boat, there was nothing but fishing boats in the harbor, so there were no masthead lights to enliven the night there, and every last light in the houses had been turned off. Moreover, here in a fishing village, where the roofs were made of tile or galvanized iron, there were none of those rows of thick black roofs that seemed so imposing at night in a farm village. There was none of the solemn weightiness of thatch to intimidate and hold back the night. Yasuo quickly mounted the sloping street to the right, his sneakers making not so much as a footfall. He passed through the playground of the elementary school, enclosed in rows of cherry trees, their blossoms half open. This playground was a recent addition to the school, and the cherry trees had been transplanted from the mountains. One of the young trees had been blown over by the storm. Its trunk showed dead black against a moonlit sand pile. Yasuo climbed the stone steps beside the stream until he reached a spot where he could hear the sound of the spring. In the light of the solitary street lamp, he could see the outlines of the spring. Clear water flowed out from between moss-covered rocks into a stone cistern, and then brimmed over one edge of the stone. The stone there was covered with glossy moss, and it seemed not that water was flowing down over the moss, but that the moss had been thickly coated with some beautiful transparent enamel. From somewhere in the thicket around the spring, an owl was hooting. Yasuo hid himself behind the lamppost. There was a tiny flutter of wings taking flight. Yasuo leaned against a huge beech tree and waited, trying to outstare the luminous eyes of his watch. Soon it was 2:00, and Yasuo caught sight of Hatsue coming across the schoolyard, carrying a water bucket on either end of a wooden pole across her shoulders. Her outline was sharply etched in the moonlight. Although a woman's body is ill-suited for midnight labor, on Utajima, men and women alike, rich and poor, had to perform their own tasks. Robust Hatsue, hardened by the life of a diving woman, came up the stone steps without the slightest difficulty, swinging the empty pails to and fro and giving rather the merry appearance of actually enjoying her untimely work. At long last, Hatsue had put her buckets down beside the spring. This was the moment when Yasuo had intended to jump out at her, but now he hesitated and decided to hold back until she had finished drawing her water. Preparing to leap out when the moment came, he reached up and caught hold of a high branch with his left hand. Then he stood perfectly still, imagining himself to be a stone statue. He watched the girl's strong hands, red and slightly frostbitten, as she filled the buckets, splashing the water about with lush sounds, and the sight quickened his imagination with delightfully carnal pictures of her healthy young body. All the time, the luminous watch of which Yasuo was so proud, strapped above the hand with which he was holding onto the branch of the beech tree, was giving off its phosphorescent glow, faintly but distinctly ticking away the seconds. This aroused a swarm of hornets in the nest fastened to the same branch and greatly excited their curiosity. One of the hornets came flying timidly toward the wristwatch, only to find that this strange beetle that emitted a shimmering light and chirruped methodically was protected within slippery, cold armor of glass. Perhaps out of disappointment, the hornet turned its stinger toward the skin at Yasuo's wrist and drove it in with all its might. Yasuo gave a shout. Hatsuo straightened up and turned in his direction, but she did not even so much as scream. Instead, in a flash, she had the ropes off the carrying pole and, holding the pole slantwise across her body, took up a posture of defense. Even Yasuo had to admit he must have been a sorry sight in Hatsue's eyes. She retreated a step or two before him, keeping the same defensive posture. Yasuo decided it would be better to turn it all off as a joke. He broke into foolish laughter and said, "Hey, I guess I scared you. You thought I was a hobgoblin, didn't you?"
"Why, it's Brother Yasuo."
"I thought I'd hide here and give you a scare."
"But at this time of night?"
The girl did not yet realize how very attractive she was. Perhaps she might have if she had thought about it deeply enough, but just now she accepted Yasuo's explanation that he had actually hidden here for no other reason than to frighten her. In an instant, taking advantage of her trustfulness, Yasuo snatched the pole away from her and caught her by the right wrist. The leather of Yasuo's jacket was making creaking sounds. Yasuo had finally recovered his poise. He stood glaring at Hatsue. Now he was quite self-possessed, and, intending to win the girl fairly, he fell unconsciously into an imitation of the open and above-board manner he imagined Shinji might have used on a similar occasion. "All right," he said reasonably. "Now will you listen to what I've got to say? You'll be sorry if you don't, so you'd better listen, unless you want everybody to know about you and Shinji." Hatsue's face was flushed, and she was breathing hard.
"Let go of my arm! What do you mean about me and Shinji?"
"Don't act so innocent. As though you haven't been playing around with Shinji. You really put one over on me."
"Don't say such ridiculous things. I haven't done any such thing."
"Me? I know all about it. What was it you did with Shinji up on the mountain the other day in the storm?" "Hey, just look at her blush. So now you're going to do the same thing with me. Come on. Come on.
Get away! Get away from me!"
Hatsue struggled, trying to escape. Yasuo would not let her go. She would be sure to tell her father if she got away now, before anything happened. But afterwards, then she wouldn't tell a soul. Yasuo was hopelessly addicted to the pulp magazines which came from the city with their frequent confessions of girls who had been seduced. What a grand feeling it was to be able to do this to a girl and yet be sure that she could never tell anyone about it. Yasuo finally had Hatsue pinned to the ground beside the spring. One of the buckets had been knocked over and the water was running over the moss-covered earth. The light of the street lamp showed Hatsue's nostrils quivering and her wide-open eyes flashing. Her hair was half in the spilled water. Suddenly, Hatsue pursed her lips and spat full on Yasuo's chin. This aroused his passion all the more, and feeling her heaving breasts beneath him, he thrust his face against her cheek. At that moment, he gave a shout and jumped to his feet. The hornet had stung him again, this time on the nape of the neck. Angered beyond endurance, he tried wildly to catch the hornet, and while he was dancing about, Hatsue went running toward the stone steps. Yasuo was in a panic of confusion. He was fully occupied with the hornet,
and yet still managed somehow to satisfy his urge to recapture Hatsue. But from one moment to the next, he had no idea which action he was performing, nor in what order. At any rate, catch Hatsue again he did. No sooner had he forced her ripening body down again onto the moss than the persistent hornet lit, this time on the seat of Yasuo's trousers, and drove its stinger deeply into the flesh of a buttock. Hatsue was gaining experience in the art of escape, and when Yasuo leaped up, this time she fled to the far side of the spring. As she dived into the grove of trees and ran to hide behind a clump of ferns, she caught sight of a big rock. Holding the rock over her head in both hands, she finally got her breath and looked down across the spring. As a matter of fact, until that moment, Hatsue had not known what god it was who had come to her rescue, but now, as she suspiciously watched Yasuo's mad cavortings on the other side of the spring, she realized it was all the doing of a clever hornet. Yasuo's hands clawed the air, and she could see, just at their fingertips, full in the light of the street lamp, the flashing of little golden-colored wings. When he at last realized he had driven the hornet away, Yasuo stood looking blank and wiped the sweat off his face with his handcloth. Then he looked around for Hatsue. Seeing no trace of her, he made a trumpet with his hands and nervously called her name in a low voice. Hatsue deliberately rustled some ferns with her toe. "Come down here from up there, won't you? I promise not to do anything else."
"No, I won't."
"Come on down, please."
He started to climb up, and Hatsue brandished the stone. Yasuo drew back.
"Hey, what are you doing? Watch out, that's dangerous. What can I do to get you to come down?"
Yasuo would have liked to run away without more ceremony, but his fear that she would tell her father kept him wheedling.
"Please, I'll do anything you say, just so you come on down. I suppose you're going to tell your father on me, aren't you?"
There was no answer.
"Come on, please, don't tell your father. I'll do anything you say, if only you won't tell. What do you want me to do?"
"Well, if you'll draw the water for me and carry it all the way home..."
"Really?"
"Really."
"All right, I'll sure do it then. That Uncle Teru is really something to be afraid of."
Then Yasuo silently set about his task, earnestly, wholeheartedly, making a truly ridiculous sight. He refilled the bucket that had been overturned, put the rope handles of the buckets on the pole, shouldered the pole, and began walking. After a moment, Yasuo glanced back and saw that Hatsue had come down from the grove without his knowing it, and was following along about 2 yards behind him. She did not so much as smile. When she saw him stop walking, she stopped too, and when he started on down the steps again, she started too. The village was still buried in sleep, its roofs bathed in moonlight. But as they descended the stone stairs toward the village step by step, they could hear rising up to them the crowing of cocks from all sides, a sign that the dawn was near.
Chapter 10 Shinji's brother returned home to the island. The mothers were waiting on the jetty to welcome their sons. There was a drizzling rain, and the open sea was invisible. The ferryboat was only about 100 yards from the jetty when its shape came into view through the mist. In the same breath, each mother called the name of her own son. Now they could plainly see the caps and handkerchiefs being waved from the deck. The boat had arrived, but even when they were ashore, face to face with their mothers, these middle school boys only smiled a little and went right on playing around among themselves. They all disliked showing affection for their mothers in each other's presence. Even after he was at his own home, Hiroshi was still too excited to settle down. About all he could tell of his trip were incidents such as the morning he had been so sleepy because one of his friends had been afraid to go to the toilet by himself the night before, and had pounded Hiroshi awake in the middle of the night to go with him. But not a word did Hiroshi have for all the famous historic spots they had visited. Certainly, Hiroshi had brought back some deep impressions from his trip, but he did not know how to put them into words.
He would try to think of something to say, and all he could recall would be something like the time already a year or so ago when he had had such fun waxing a spot on the corridor floor at school and seeing one of the women teachers slip on it and fall. Those gleaming streetcars and automobiles that had come upon him so suddenly flashed by and disappeared. Those towering buildings and neon lights that had so amazed him, where were they now? Here at home, looking just the same as they had before he had gone away, there was still the same old cupboard, wall clock, Buddhist altar, dining table, dressing table, and the same old mother. There were the cook stove and the dirty straw mats. These things could understand him even without words, and yet all of them, including even his mother, were at him to tell them about his travels. Hiroshi finally calmed down about the time Shinji came home from the day's fishing. After supper, he opened his travel diary and gave his mother and brother a perfunctory account of his trip. Satisfied, they ceased questioning him about the excursion. Everything was back to normal. His became again an existence in which everything was understood without the need for words. The cupboard, the wall clock, his mother, his brother, the old sooty cook stove, the seas roaring. Folded in these familiar arms, Hiroshi slept soundly. Hiroshi's summer vacation was nearing its end, so every day from the moment he got up until he went to bed, he was playing with all his might. The island abounded in places to play. Hiroshi and his friends had finally seen the Western movies that until that time they had only heard about, and the new game of cowboys and Indians had now become a great favorite with them. The sight of smoke rising from a forest fire around Motoura on Shima Peninsula across the sea inevitably reminded them of signal fires rising from some Indian stronghold. The cormorants of Utajima were birds of passage, and by this time of year they were vanishing one by one. All over the island, the songs of nightingales were now frequently heard. The steep pass leading down to the middle school was known as Red Nose Pass because of its effect on the noses of passers-by in the winter, when it received every blast that blew. But now, no matter how cool the day, the breezes there would not even so much as turn a nose pink. Bentem Promontory, at the southern tip of the island, provided the boys with their western locale. The western side of the promontory was entirely of limestone, and it led finally to the entrance of a cave, one of the most mysterious spots on Utajima. The entrance to the cave was small, only about a yard and a half wide and 2 feet high, but the winding passageway leading into the interior gradually widened out into a three-tiered cavern. Until that point, the passageway was truly black, but a strange half-light wavered within the cavern proper. This was because the cave actually went completely through the promontory to an invisible opening on the eastern side, where the sea entered, rising and falling at the bottom of a deep shaft in the rock. Candles in hand, the gang entered the cave. Calling, "Watch out!" and "Be careful!" to each other, they went crawling through the dark passageway. They could see each other's faces floating on the darkness, tinted with grimness in the flickering candlelight, and they thought how wonderful they would look in this light if only they had the unshaven beards of young toughs. The gang was made up of Hiroshi, So-chan, and Kat-chan. They were on their way to search for Indian treasure deep in the farthest recesses of the cavern. So-chan was in the lead, and when they came out into the cavern, where they could at last stand erect, his head was splendidly covered with thickly woven cobwebs. "Hey, look at you!" Hiroshi and Kat-chan chorused. "Your hair's all decorated! You can be the chieftain!" They stood their three candles up beneath a Sanskrit inscription some unknown person had carved long ago on one of the moss-covered walls. The sea, ebbing and flowing in the shaft at the eastern end of the cave, roared fiercely as it dashed against the rocks. The sound of the surging waves was completely different from that to which they were accustomed outside. It was a seething sound that echoed off the limestone walls of the cavern,
the reverberations overlapping each other until the entire cave was a roar and seemed to be pitching and swaying. Shudderingly, they recalled the legend that between the 16th and 18th days of the sixth moon, 7 pure white sharks were supposed to appear out of nowhere within that shaft to the sea. In this game, the boys change their parts at will, shifting between the roles of enemies and friends with the greatest of ease. So-chan had been made an Indian chief because of the cobwebs in his hair, and the other two were frontier guards, implacable enemies of all Indians. But now, wanting to ask the chief why the waves echoed so frighteningly, they suddenly became his two loyal braves. So-chan understood the change immediately and seated himself with great dignity on a rock beneath the candles.
"Oh, chief, what terrible sound is this that we hear?"
"This, my children," said So-chan in solemn tones, "this is the god showing his anger."
"And what can we do to appease the god's anger?" Hiroshi asked.
"Well, now let me see."
"Yes, the only thing to do is to make him an offering and then pray."
So they took the rice crackers and bean jam buns that they had either received or filched from their mothers, arranged them on a sheet of newspaper, and ceremonially placed them on a rock overlooking the shaft. Chief So-chan walked between the two braves, advancing with pomp to the altar, where after prostrating himself on the limestone floor, he raised both arms high, chanted a curious impromptu incantation, and then prayed, bending the upper half of his body back and forth. Behind the chieftain, Hiroshi and Kachan went through the same genuflections. The cold surface of the stone pressed through their trousers and touched their kneecaps, and all the while Hiroshi and the others felt themselves in very truth to be characters in a movie. Fortunately, the god's wrath seemed to have been placated, and the roar of the waves became a little quieter. So they sat in a circle and ate the offerings of rice crackers and bean jam buns from the altar. The food tasted 10 times more delicious than usual. Just then, a still more tremendous roar sounded, and a spray of water flung itself high out of the shaft. In the gloom, the sudden spray looked like a white phantom. The waters set the cavern to rumbling and swaying, and it seemed as though the sea were looking for a chance to snatch even these 3 Indians seated in a circle within the stone room and pull them to its depths. In spite of themselves, Hiroshi, So-chan, and Kachan were afraid, and when a stray gust of wind blew out of nowhere, fluttering the flames of the candles beneath the Sanskrit inscription and finally blowing one out altogether, their fear grew still stronger. But the 3 of them were always trying to outdo each other in displays of bravery. So, with the cheerful instinct of all boys, they quickly hid their fear under the guise of playing the game. Hiroshi and Kachan became 2 cowardly Indian braves, trembling with fear.
"Oh, oh, I'm afraid, I'm afraid. Oh, chief, the god is terribly angry. What could have made him so angry? Tell us, oh, chief."
So-chan sat on a throne of stone, trembling and shaking majestically like the chieftain he was. Pressed for an answer, he recalled the gossip that had been secretly whispered about the island during the past few days and, without any evil purpose, decided to make use of it. He cleared his throat and spoke.
"It is because of an immorality. It is because of an unrighteousness."
"Immorality?" asked Hiroshi. "What do you mean?"
"Don't you know, Hiroshi? I mean what your brother Shinji did to Miyata's daughter, Hatsue? I mean Omeko? That's what. And that's what the god is angry about."
Hearing his brother mentioned and feeling something disgraceful was being said about him, Hiroshi flared out at the chieftain in a rage.
"What's that you say my brother did with sister Hatsue? What do you mean by Omeko? Don't you even know that? It means when a boy and a girl sleep together."
Actually, So-chan himself knew little more about the word than this, but he knew how to smear his explanation thoroughly with insulting colors, and in a fit of rage, Hiroshi went flying at So-chan. Before he realized it, So-chan felt his shoulders grabbed and his cheeks slapped. But the scuffle ended disappointingly soon. When Sochan was knocked against the wall, the two remaining candles fell to the ground and went out. In the cavern there remained only the dim light, barely sufficient for them to see each other's faces vaguely. Hiroshi and Sochan were still facing each other, breathing hard, but they gradually realized what danger they were inviting by fighting in such a spot. Kachan intervened, saying, "Stop fighting! Can't you see it's dangerous here?" So they struck matches, found their candles, and went crawling out of the cave, saying practically nothing. By the time they had scrambled up the cliff, bathed in the bright light of outdoors, and reached the ridge of the promontory, they were again as good friends as ever, seeming to have forgotten all about their fight of a little while before. They walked the narrow path along the ridge of the promontory, singing, "Along the five-league beach of Benten Hachijo, and all along the garden beach." This five-league beach was the most beautiful stretch of coastline on the island, lying along the western side of Benten Promontory. Halfway along the beach towered a huge rock called Hachijo Isle, as tall as a two-storied house, and just now, among the rank-growing vines on its summit, there were four or five playful urchins, waving their hands and shouting something. The three boys waved back in reply and walked on along the path. Here and there in the soft grass among the pine trees, there were patches of milk vetch, blooming red.
"Look, the seining boats!"
Kachan pointed to the sea off the eastern shore of the promontory. On that shore, the garden beach embraced a lovely little cove, and at its mouth there were now three seining boats floating motionless, waiting for the tide. These were the boats that manipulated the dragnets as they were pulled along the ocean floor by larger vessels. Hiroshi said, "Look!" also, and, together with his friends, squinted out over the dazzling sea, but the words Sochan had spoken earlier still weighed on his spirit, seeming to become heavier and heavier as time passed. At supper time, Hiroshi returned home with an empty stomach. Shinji was not yet home, and his mother was alone, feeding brushwood into the cook stove. There was the sound of the crackling wood and the wind-like sound of the fire inside the stove, and it was only at times like this that delicious smells erased the stench of the toilet.
"Mother,"
Hiroshi said, lying spread-eagled on the straw matting.
"What?"
"What's omeko? Somebody said that's what Shinji did to Hatsue. What do they mean?"
Before Hiroshi realized it, his mother had left the stove and was sitting straight beside the spot where he lay. Her eyes were flashing strangely, flashing through some fallen strands of hair to give her a frightening look.
"Hiroshi, you... where'd you hear that? Who said such a thing?"
"So-chan?"
"Don't you ever say that again. You mustn't even say that to your brother. If you do, it'll be many a day before I give you anything to eat again. Do you hear what I say?"
The mother took a very tolerant view of young people's amorous affairs. And even during the diving season, when everyone stood about the drying fire gossiping, she held her tongue. But when it came to its being her own son's affair that was the subject of malicious gossip, then there was a motherly duty that she would have to perform. That night, after Hiroshi was asleep, the mother leaned close to Shinji's ear and spoke in a low, firm voice.
"Do you know people are spreading bad stories about you and Hatsue?"
Shinji shook his head and blushed. His mother, too, was embarrassed, but she pressed the point with unwavering frankness.
"Did you sleep with her?"
Again, Shinji shook his head.
"Then you've not done a thing that people could talk about? Are you telling me the truth?"
"Yes, I've told you the truth."
"All right. Then there's nothing for me to say. But do be careful. People are always minding other people's business."
But the situation did not take a turn for the better. The following evening, Shinji's mother went to a meeting of the Ape God Society, the women's one and only club, and the moment she appeared, everyone stopped talking, looking as though they had just had a wet blanket thrown over them. Obviously, they had been gossiping. The next evening, when Shinji went to the Young Men's Association, flinging the door open as casually as always, he found a group of youths gathering around the desk, eagerly discussing something beneath the glare of the unshaded electric bulb.
When they caught sight of Shinji, they fell silent for a moment. There was nothing but the sound of the sea floating in to fill the bleak room, seemingly empty of all human life. As usual, Shinji sat down against the wall, wrapped his arms around his knees, and said not a word. Thereupon, everyone began talking again in their usual noisy way about a different subject, and Yasuo, the president, who had come to the meeting strangely early today, greeted Shinji from across the desk in a hail fellow well-met way. Shinji returned the greeting with an unsuspecting smile. A few days later, while they were eating their lunch on the Taiheimaru and resting from fishing, Ryuji spoke up as though unable to contain himself any longer. "Brother Shing, it really makes my blood boil, the way Yasuo is going around saying such bad things about you."
"Is he?" Shinji smiled and kept a manly silence. The boat was gently rolling on the spring waves. Suddenly, Jukichi, usually so taciturn, broke into the conversation.
"I know, I know. That Yasuo is jealous. The scamp's nothing but a big fool, sticking up his nose because of his father. He makes me sick. So now Shinji, too, has become a great ladies' man, and Yasuo's burned up with jealousy. Don't you pay any attention to what they say, Shinji. If there's any trouble, I'm on your side."
Thus the rumor, which Chiyoko had originated and Yasuo had broadcast, came to be whispered persistently at every crossroads in the village. And yet it still had not reached the ears of Hatsue's father. Then one night, there occurred the incident that the village would not tire of talking about for months to come. It took place at the public bathhouse. Even the richest houses in the village did not have their own baths, and on this night, Terukichi Miyata went to the public bath as usual. He brushed through the curtain at the entrance with a haughty toss of the head, ripped off his clothes as though plucking a fowl, and flung them toward a wicker basket. His singlet and sash missed the basket and scattered themselves across the floor. Clicking his tongue loudly, he picked the garments up with his toes and threw them in the basket. It was an awesome sight to those who were watching, but this was one of the few opportunities left for Hatsue's father to give public proof that, old though he was, his vigor was undiminished. Actually, his aged nudity was a marvel to behold. His gold and copper-colored limbs showed no sign of slackness, and above his piercing eyes and stubborn forehead, his white hair bristled wildly like the mane of a lion. His chest was a ruddy red from many years of heavy drinking, providing an impressive contrast for his white hair. His bulging muscles had become hardened through long disuse, reinforcing the impression of a crag that has become all the more precipitous under the pounding of the waves. It might be better to say that Terukichi was the personification of all Utajima's toil and determination and ambition and strength. Full of the somewhat uncouth energy of a man who had raised his family from nothing to wealth in a single generation, he was also narrow-minded enough never to have accepted any public office in the village, a fact that made him all the more respected by the leading people of the village. The uncanny accuracy of his weather predictions, his matchless experience in matters of fishing and navigation, and the great pride he took in knowing all the history and traditions of the island were often offset by his uncompromising stubbornness, his ludicrous pretensions, and his pugnacity, which abated not a whit with the years. But in any case, he was an old man who, while still living, could act like a bronze statue erected to his own memory and without appearing ridiculous. He slid open the glass door leading from the dressing room into the bath. The bathroom was fairly crowded, and through the clouds of steam there appeared the vague outlines of people moving about. The ceiling resounded with the sounds of water, the light tapping noises of wooden basins, and laughing conversation. The room was filled with abundant hot water and a feeling of release after the day's labor. Terukichi never rinsed his body before entering the pool. Now, as always, he walked in long, dignified strides directly from the door to the pool and, without further ado, thrust his legs into the water.
It made no difference to him how hot the water might be. Terukichi had no more interest in such things as the possible effect of heat upon his heart and the blood vessels in his brain than he had in, say, perfume or neckties. Even though their faces got splashed with water, when the bathers realized it was Terukichi, they nodded to him courteously. Terukichi immersed himself up to his arrogant chin. There were two young fishermen who were washing themselves beside the pool and had not noticed Terukichi's arrival. In loud voices, they went right on with their unrestrained gossip about Terukichi.
"Uncle Teru Miyata really must be in his second childhood. He doesn't even know his girl's become a cracked pitcher. That Shinji Kubo, didn't he pull a fast one, though? While everybody was thinking that he was such a kid, there he went and stole her right from under Uncle Teru's nose."
The people in the pool were fidgety and kept their eyes turned away from Terukichi. Terukichi was boiling red, but his face was outwardly composed as he got out of the pool. Taking a wooden basin in each hand, he went and filled them from the cold water tank. Then he walked over to the two youths, poured the icy water over their heads without warning, and kicked them in the back. The boys, their eyes half closed with soap, immediately started to strike back, but then they realized it was Terukichi they were up against and hesitated. The old man next caught them both by the scruff of the neck, and even though their soapy skin was slippery under his fingers, dragged them to the edge of the pool. There he gave them a tremendous shove, burying their heads in the hot water. Still grasping their necks tightly in his big hands, the old man shook the two heads in the water and knocked them together, just as though he were rinsing out laundry. Then, to top it all, without even washing himself, Terukichi stalked from the room with his long strides, not giving so much as a glance at the backsides of the other bathers, who had now risen to their feet and were left staring after him in blank amazement.
Chapter 11. While they were eating their lunch the next day on the Taihei-maru, the master opened his tobacco pouch and took out a piece of paper folded very small. Grinning broadly, he held it out to Shinji. But when Shinji reached for it, Jukichi said,
"Now listen, if I give you this, will you promise not to start loafing around after you've read it?"
"I'm not that sort of fellow," Shinji replied, definitely and to the point.
"All right. It's a man's promise. This morning when I was passing Uncle Teru's house, Hatsue came trotting out and pressed this note tight in my hand. She didn't say a word and went right back inside. I was tickled to think of getting a love letter at my age, but then I opened it, and how should it begin but, 'Dear Shinji.' 'You old fool,' I told myself, and I was just about to tear it up and throw it in the ocean, but then I told myself that would be a shame, so I brought it along for you." Shinji took the note, while both the master and Ryuji laughed. The thin paper had been folded many times into a small pellet, and Shinji opened it gingerly, careful not to tear it in his thick, knobby fingers. Tobacco dust sifted onto his hands from the folds. She had started writing on the notepaper with ink, but after a few lines her fountain pen had apparently run dry, and she had continued with a faint pencil. Written in a childish hand, the note said,
"Last night, at the bath, Father heard some very bad gossip about us and became terribly angry and commanded that I must never see Shinji-san again. No matter how much I explained, it was no use, not with Father's being the kind of man he is. He says I must never go out of the house from the time the fishing boats come back in the afternoon until after they've gone out in the morning. He says he'll get the lady next door to draw water for us when our turn comes. So there's nothing I can do. I'm so miserable, so very miserable. I can't stand it. And he says that on the days when the boats don't go out, he'll be right at my side and never take his eyes off me. How will I ever be able to see Shinji-san again? Please think of some way for us to meet. I'm afraid for us to send letters by mail because the old postmaster would know all about it. So every day I'll write a letter and stick it under the lid on the water jar in front of our kitchen. Please put your replies in the same place, but it would be dangerous for you to come here yourself to get the letters, so please get some friend you trust to come for you. I've been on the island such a short time that I don't know anybody I can really trust. Oh, Shinji-san,
Let us go on truly, with strong hearts. Every day I will be praying before the memorial tablets of my mother and brother that no accident will befall Shinji-san. I'm sure that they in heaven will understand how I feel.
As Shinji read the note, the expression on his face alternated, like sunshine and shadow, between the sorrow of being separated from Hatsue and the joy of having this proof of her affection for him. Just as Shinji finished reading the note, Jukichi snatched it out of his hands as though this were only the rightful due of a bearer of love messages and read it through. Not only did he read it aloud for Ryuji's benefit, but he also read it in his own unique ballad-chanting style. Shinji knew that Jukichi always read the newspaper aloud to himself in this same chanting tone, and that he was using it now without the slightest malice, but still it hurt to have such a travesty made of those earnest words written by the girl he loved. As a matter of fact, Jukichi was sincerely moved by the letter, and during the reading, he heaved many a big sigh and threw in many an interjection. When he was done, he gave his opinion in the same powerful voice he used to give fishing orders, a voice that now boomed out over the quiet noonday sea to a radius of 100 yards in all directions.
Women really are wise ones, aren't they?
Here in the boat, there were none to hear except these two whom he trusted. So at Jukichi's urging, Shinji gradually confided in them. His way of telling the story was awkward. Events were often told in the wrong order, and he would leave out important points. It took him quite a time just to give a brief outline. Finally, he reached the heart of the matter and told them how on that day of the storm, even though they were naked in each other's arms, he had been unable to win the prize after all. At this point, Jukichi, who almost never smiled, could not stop laughing.
If it had been me, oh, if it had been me, really, what a mess you made of things. But then, I guess that's what comes of your being such a virgin. And besides, the girl's so almighty straight-laced that she was too big a handful for you. But still, it's a ridiculous story. Oh well, it'll be all right after she's your wife. Then you'll make up for it by giving her the rod 10 times a day.
Ryuji, a year younger than Shinji, was listening to this talk as though he only half understood it. As for Shinji, he was not sensitive and easily wounded the way a city-bred boy is during the time of his first love, and to Shinji, the old man's raillery was actually soothing and comforting rather than upsetting. The gentle waves that rocked their boat also calmed his heart, and now that he had told the whole story, he was at peace. This place of toil had become for him a place of matchless rest. Ryuji, who passed Terukichi's house on his way to the beach, volunteered to pick up Hatsue's letter from under the lid of the water jar each morning.
"So, from tomorrow, you'll be the new postmaster," said Jukichi, making one of his rare jokes.
The daily letters became the principal subject of conversation during their lunch hours on the boat, and the three of them always shared the anguish and the anger called forth by the contents of the letters. The second letter in particular aroused their indignation. In it, Hatsue described at length how Yasuo had attacked her by the spring in the middle of the night and the threats he'd made. She'd kept her promise and not told about it, but Yasuo had avenged himself by spreading that false story about her and Shinji through the village. Then, when her father had forbidden her to see Shinji again, she had explained everything honestly and had also told him of Yasuo's disgraceful behavior. But her father had not done a thing about Yasuo, had, in fact, even remained on as friendly terms as ever with Yasuo's family, with the same visiting back and forth. But she herself detested the very sight of Yasuo's face. She ended the letter by assuring Shinji that she would never, never let her guard down against Yasuo. Ryuji became excited on Shinji's behalf, and even Shinji's eyes flashed with a rare expression of anger.
"It's all because I'm poor," Shinji said.
He was usually not one to let such querulous words pass his lips, and he felt tears of shame springing in his eyes, not because he was poor, but because he had been weak enough to give voice to such a complaint. But then he tightened his face with all his might, defying those unexpected tears and managed to avoid the double shame of having the others see him cry. This time, Jukichi did not laugh. Jukichi took great pleasure in tobacco and had the odd habit of alternating between a pipe one day and cigarettes the next. Today was the turn for cigarettes. On pipe days, he was forever knocking his tiny